of his career, and I believe the first recording we're going to hear is one of the first recordings that he became well known for.
Yeah, it's from 1957, and it's composed by George Russell, who himself became a very fine pianist, but chose to have Bill Evans play piano on this track, which is pretty revealing right there. And I think it was written specifically for Bill Evans. It's called Concerto for Billy the Kid and has very little to do with Aaron Copland. And Russell later expanded this into a longer piece called All About Rosie, which was based on the children's game, Ring Around the Rosie. And it again featured Bill Evans. This is the shorter version. And I don't think we're losing very much by hearing only the shorter version, because I think this is actually the better work. And you can hear things in Evans' style that some people think disappeared later on. This is very muscular playing, and he uses his left hand very, very convincingly. So should we hear that now?
Okay, and this is Concerto for Billy the Kid, featuring the playing of pianist Bill Evans. Thank you. was Concerto for Billy the Kid, written by George Russell, recorded in 1957, spotlighting the piano playing of Bill Evans, who died yesterday at the age of 51. If you're just joining us, Francis Davis, the host of Interval, our out-of-print jazz feature, is with me this afternoon to play some of the recordings that Bill Evans has made through his career and to talk with us about his music and about his life. Francis, what do you think are some of the influences that Bill Evans and his music have had on other pianists of his time?
Well, I think his influence was specifically on pianists, as opposed to somebody say like McCoy Tyner or Cecil Taylor, who seems to influence not only other pianists but other instrumentalists. But that influence, that Evans' influence, is all pervasive. It's really impossible to go into a restaurant where there's a piano player playing for diners without hearing some Bill Evans, either in that the performer is playing a piece that Evans recorded, a standard, say, that Evans recorded, and probably knows it from either the record or a Bill Evans songbook, or just in the style. There's a certain Bill Evans style that you can hear in really odd places. There was a TV commercial several years ago for a brand of tuna. Can I say the brand?
Sure, yeah.
Three Diamonds, which was probably played by some West Coast pianist, but it really sounded like Bill Evans and the sound of the Bill Evans Trio. I think Evans had a really profound effect on the players who comprise the ECM stable of artists, along with Miles Davis and John Coltrane, who I think also influenced that music. But that certain tranquil sense, almost a sense of quietude, it's really maybe a miscomprehension of what Evans's music meant, but in the music of people like Chick Corea, Keith Jarrett, the group Aragon, you can hear a lot of Bill Evans. And they perform Evans tunes, by the way.
I remember one day in the Fresh Air office, we had about five of Bill Evans' records sitting on one of the desks, and there were photographs of him on each one, and he looked very different in each of them. And Danny Miller said that if you look at Evans' albums, he looks almost like a quick change artist, since he's dressed differently, has different length hair, some he has a beard, some he doesn't have a beard, and it somehow changes the whole shape of his face and his appearance. You've seen him in concert recently. What was he like to watch in concert?
Almost very painful because of his posture on the bench. I should add that anybody wanting to see Bill Evans in concert, I don't know if this will ever be rerun, but recently on Channel 12 in the series Jazz at the Maintenance Shop, there were two Bill Evans programs, of which I saw the first. And it was a pretty interesting program in the sense of giving a sense of what Evans was like in concert. But Evans sits on the piano bench, or sat on the piano bench, with his shoulders hunched roundly forward and his neck bent almost parallel to the keyboard, so that often no head appeared above his collar. And it's a pretty painful posture if you're the kind of person that sits behind a pianist and really so engrossed in what somebody like Bill Evans is playing that you tend to assume the posture, especially if you're the sort of person whose hands tap out. Well, we won't even talk about that. But anyway, I found myself in real pain watching Evans, but it was really delighted pain. And other than that, he was almost immobile on the bench. Nothing moved except for his limbs. You could see his foot applying discrete pressure to the pedals now and then. And, of course, his hands and his arms and his hands spreading very, very far to realize his voicings. So he was really fascinating to watch. And even though his appearance changed, I guess he was a very average-looking person, and certainly usually performed wearing a suit. And it's really interesting to me that there should be such a good Evans TV program as the one I just mentioned, because the rap against jazz on television is that it's not supposed to be a visual music, I guess because the people aren't wearing loud ties and shirts or something. But Evans was certainly fascinating to watch and really gives the lie to that. If somebody's really sympathetic to what's going on, there's no end of things to look at. I think right now we should hear Bill Evans play with Miles Davis for two reasons. The Miles Davis stint was very important. First of all, it brought Evans to the attention of a larger public, and after leaving Miles Davis, he formed his own trio. and we'll hear the work of that trio later in the program. But also because Bill Evans seems really important to Miles Davis at that time. Miles had become enamored of scales and very spacious playing. And I think you can hear from the way Bill Evans plays behind Miles how important Evans was in the realization of that concept. So this is a track composed by, well, composed by Miles Davis, if you look at the Columbia record that it's on that we're playing it from, which is kind of blue. Composed by Bill Evans, if you look at Bill Evans's records, probably a collaboration. But this is called Blue and Green. Thank you. Blue and Green, a piece composed by Miles Davis and Bill Evans, also featuring John Coltrane. Bill Evans died yesterday of a bleeding ulcer at age 51. Bill Evans and Miles Davis seemed to have a reciprocal influence upon each other, and I think you can hear the way that Miles is playing really gathered direction at that point in his career, 1959, from the way Bill Evans countered Miles' solos with his own, and also from the way that Bill Evans played below Miles Davis. That piece, Blue and Green, seems to be based on a song called Some Other Time, a show tune written by Leonard Bernstein along with Comden and Green. And that same piece, Some Other Time, is also the source of another very famous Bill Evans performance, a solo piano performance called Peace Peace, which we'll hear in just a second. But I think what this illustrates is how little material Bill Evans used and what he did with the little material that he did use. Lee Konitz one time, a very fine alto saxophonist, Lee Konitz, one time said that a player had really to learn very, very few songs, that he had never exhausted the possibilities harmonically and melodically and rhythmically in all the songs. And that goes counter to what every musician learns, that you have to know a lot of pieces in order to get jobs, and also that you have to keep constantly changing your style to stay in fashion, and both for commercial pressures and also the pressure of your peers. They're always younger players snapping at the heels of established musicians. But Evans used very, very little material, but I think you'll sense what wonderful use he made of it, comparing this piece that we'll hear now to the piece that we heard last. This is called Peace, Peace. Thank you.
Bill Evans has recorded in about 1959 a piece called Peace, Peace. And if you're just joining us, Bill Evans died yesterday at the age of 51 by what was expected, what is thought to have been a bleeding ulcer. I believe the autopsy still hasn't been done. So Francis Davis is with us today. Francis is the host of Interval, our out-of-print jazz feature, Thursdays at 3:30. And Francis has brought with him some recorded highlights from Bill Evans' career and is talking with us about Evans' life and music. Francis, before we heard that recording, you had mentioned that Evans seemed to use a very small amount of material but made a lot of that material in his playing. You've seen him a few times in concert. What kind of material was he playing in his recent concerts?
Well, I'd seen him twice, twice within about 6 months, and I think the concerts varied not at all, really. He played a Joe Zawinul piece called Midnight Mood, the theme from MASH, Jimmy Rolls's The Peacocks, some of his own compositions, Turn Out the Stars. He may have played Waltz for Debbie in both performances. He kept reinvestigating the same material over and over again. And a lot of that had to do with changes in his group. Such was the interaction between Evans and whichever bass player he had in the band at the time, that playing Waltz for Debbie with Scott LaFaro was not like playing it with Eddie Gomez, and was not like playing it with his latest bassist, Mark Johnson. I think now I'd like to play two things by Bill Evans, both featuring trios, very famous Bill Evans trios. The first is from a Bill Evans trio formed in 1960, although this was recorded in 1961 after the group had been together for a year. And as it turns out, this live recording was the last, not only the last recording the group ever made, but the last performance, because a week after this was recorded in 1961 at the Village Vanguard, the bassist Scott LaFaro, who seemed a very liberating influence on Bill Evans, was killed in a car crash, I think exactly 7 or 8 days after this performance in June of 1961. The drummer is Paul Motion, or Paul Motion, as some people say. I think it is Motion. A drummer praised at the time in Bill Evans' bands for being unobtrusive, which I don't know if a drummer can ever be praised for being unobtrusive. I like drummers to obtrude. The track we'll hear after that is from the Montreux Jazz Festival in 1968, which is another Evans trio with another very interesting bassist, Eddie Gomez, who style really seems influenced by Scott LaFaro's, and I guess influenced by Bill Evans too, since it's impossible, probably, even though you're a bassist, to listen to Scott LaFaro without hearing Bill Evans. And the drummer on that is Jack DeJohnette, who was with Evans very, very briefly, but really seemed to drive him and really seemed to give him the kind of propulsion and the kind of direction that he needed. So we'll hear two Bill Evans trios, Waltz for Debbie, with Scott LaFaro, probably Evans's most famous composition, and then One for Helen, written for his longtime manager, Helen Keane, one of the best managers I think any musician ever had. So let's hear those now. Thank you. two by Bill Evans. That was One for Helen, recorded in 1968 at the Montreux Jazz Festival. Bill Evans on piano with Eddie Gomez on bass and Jack DeJohnette on drums. And before that, from 1961, Waltz for Debbie, Evans's best-known composition with Scott LaFaro on bass and Paul Motion on drums. Bill Evans, the late Bill Evans, we have to say now, working with two very gifted bass players.
Actually, the occasion for Francis's visit to Fresh Air today is it's an unfortunate occasion. Bill Evans died yesterday at the age of 51. He died from what we think was bleeding ulcers. That's the cause of death that was given before the autopsy was performed. So Francis has been with us this afternoon playing some of Bill Evans' work and talking about his career and his music. And we'll be hearing another one of Bill Evans' recent recordings, this time in just a couple of minutes. But Francis, is there any final things you'd like to say about Bill Evans today?
Yeah, I've been thinking about the two times that I saw Bill Evans within the same year. That was in 1979. I saw him twice in 79 and enjoyed him both times, though I thought the second time was a much superior performance, much livelier Bill Evans. But I don't know if the difference in performance would have been all that discernible to the uninterested ear. Such was Evans' evenness. Evans's singing tone was so even, and he handled all tempos with such equanimity that his performances could suffer a sameness, although to hear him at any time was supposed to be in the sway of a really superior sense of order and logic. But he was a very, even though he was one of the first musicians I admired, often I took him for granted. And when I did an interval on Bill Evans back in August of 1979, I ended by saying that and concluded that perhaps the reason I took him for granted was that I'd be able to rediscover him again from time to time. You know, after taking him for granted, there were periods, especially right before doing the show, where I wanted to listen to nothing but Bill Evans. And it occurs to me now that doesn't stop now that Evans's life has ended, that as long as there are phonograph records, people will perhaps be taking Bill Evans for granted from time to time, but he'll also be rediscovered periodically, and not just on a mass level as an influence or a great jazzman of the 50s, 60s, 70s, but for every listener personally. I think to listen to jazz piano and to hear what happened to it after Bud Powell, you have to listen to Bill Evans. There's no getting around it. He was a very great musician. The last record that he made, which came out earlier this year, is, I think, a really important one in Evans's career. He had been recording usually with trios, himself, bass and drums. This adds a trumpeter and a tenor saxophonist. It seems in one way an effort to recapture the spirit of the kind of blues session, and it certainly brought out the muscularity in Evans's style that some people had thought had gone out of it. We won't hear, unfortunately, the tracks with the trumpeter and the tenor saxophonist because we don't have time, but I'd like to recommend the record. It's called We Will Meet Again, and what we will hear from it is the solo piano piece that closes the first side. And it's a Bill Evans composition. It's the title track of the album, and it's called We Will Meet Again. Thank you.
Bill Evans playing the title recording from his last album, which was ironically titled We Will Meet Again. Francis, for someone who's just getting acquainted with Bill Evans playing, what would you recommend as a good place to start?
Well, there's a double reissue on Milestone called the Vanguard Sessions, I believe, which is the trio with Bill Evans, Scott LaFaro, and Paul Motion. And that would seem the essential Bill Evans record. And Kind of Blue, under Miles Davis's name, I think really kind of defines not only Miles' sensibility at the time, but also Bill Evans's.
Well, Francis, I want to thank you for putting together this remembrance of Bill Evans for us. Bill Evans very sadly died yesterday at the age of 51. Once again, the cause of death, probable cause of death, was given as being bleeding ulcers, but I don't believe the official autopsy has been done yet. Francis is also the host of Interval, our Thursday 3:30 feature, which is profiles of jazz musicians focusing on their out-of-print jazz recordings. Francis, thanks again for preparing this feature for us this afternoon on Fresh Air. It's 5 to 3, and this is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WUHY FM in Philadelphia. Tuesdays at about this time, Charles Hardy features his popular culture series. And the subject today is the subject of oral history, a way of going about studying the past, which has almost helped us to reevaluate what's important in the past.
Today's program is going to be on something called oral history, a technique of historical research that has recently been receiving a good deal of academic and popular attention. Now, the subject of this series has been on different aspects of American popular culture. We've had programs on detectives, television, novels of various ilks, gambling, all of which are entertainments and activities associated with American culture. And oral history may seem a bit removed from these other topics, but it does have a great deal in common with them, reflecting both popular and academic interests, and is also an important tool of popular culture studies. As practiced today, oral history is a technique only a few decades old, as it hinges upon the use of the tape recorder. And to date, its chief contribution, it seems to me, has been in the concern of many of its practitioners with the recording and interpretation of the life experiences of large segments and subgroups of the American population who have traditionally been excluded from historical studies, indeed often from history itself. Oral history as a field has grown along with the study of popular culture and women's, black, and ethnic studies as part of the major academic and indeed broader social movement to re-enfranchise these groups into the American world. Pluralism is one popular term for this new vision. The spreading interest in oral history, too, is illustrative of a renewed national interest in the past as a source of identity and of values grounded in the actual historical experiences of America's different peoples. It is in part, too, a combat against the popular media, notably ahistorical in their content and thinking. To get a better understanding of what this whole field of oral history is, I spoke to Mike Frisch, a professor of history at the University of Buffalo, who is presently a research associate at the Center for Philadelphia Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. The first question I asked Mike was for a definition of oral history.
Well, I think like many forms of historical research, it's a pretty broad umbrella under which many things can be sheltered. If you're looking for a definition, I think probably the best I've ever come across is the idea that oral history is a kind of historical research in which the researcher is creating the documents that he's studying through an active interaction with the sources. I mean, usually one goes and reads something or finds a document that happened in the past and then one studies it in the present. In oral history, the document actually doesn't exist until there's an interaction between the historian and a potential source through the form of an interview. Beyond that, which really just describes the process, oral history can cover so many things, from informal reminiscences, from an attempt to get the spirit of a bygone age, whether it's the frontier experience in a small town in some unsettled area, or the debriefing of a decision maker. And really, those are very, very different kinds of things. To ask a former Secretary of State exactly what did you say, you know, at the summit conference just before the Russian ambassador walked out is one type of question. To ask somebody else what did it feel like going from Oklahoma to California, in the Dust Bowl days, is a very different kinds of thing. We call them both oral history because they both can be elicited through interviews. But essentially, I would say that the methodological focus. The idea of actually going to live sources and asking them a variety of questions about what happened and what it meant and what they think about it is the essence of what currently is being called oral history.
Historians have always done this, though, haven't they? Gone to the people who had actually had the life experiences that are being studied.
Well, yes and no.
Or lived through events. I'm leading as a why has the term oral history come up in the last 10, 20
for several
years?
Reasons. One is that I think there's far more of a historians have often done interviews in the same way the journalists do interviews. The interviews were often very specifically directed at a particular problem. Let's say that an historian was working on, again, the ambassador question. Example that I gave is probably the best kind of example of that. What has become more interesting to people and has been called oral history is the notion of creating, not so much to answer a specific question in the course of an ongoing research project, but to use the oral method while people are still available to be interviewed to assemble essentially an archive of information, of historical information, which can be used in other researches as yet, you know, unanticipated. This really probably was set mostly at Columbia University in the project devised by Alan Nevins, where essentially the insight in the 40s and 50s was that in the modern age, people don't write as many letters. We're not going to have the kinds of documentary collections for decision makers that we are used to relying on for historical research. So before people die, we might as well sit them down and find out everything they might want to say that might be of interest to somebody later. This was done, you might say, from the top down with the program at Columbia, which was basically a kind of elite interviewing program. In other ways, it was done from the bottom up, from a very similar point of view, a very similar insight in the slave narratives collected by the WPA. These weren't done on tape for the most part, but again, the idea was the same, that future historians will be interested in what these people had to say. At that point in the 30s, it was realized that the generation of people who actually had been slaves, you know, freed by the Civil War, would, of course, all be, they were quite aged then and would all be passing from the scene within the next 10 or 20 years. So if we didn't get them now and find out what they had to say, what they remembered, what they might want to pass on, then there would be no chance to do that. And, of course, these were not people who generally wrote diaries or extensive memoirs or had letter collections that were likely to end up in the Library of Congress either. So I think what has generated this newer interest in urban history as opposed to older historical journalism is the idea of assembling in advance a less topically focused and more generally useful historical archive of people's experiences, memories, and so forth that can provide a data bank and a resource bank and a vast pool of historical information, reminiscences, opinions, and experiences that we can all be enriched by in looking them over in the years to come.
What's the value of this? You know, assembling all of these interviews and.
Well, the value is, in one sense, archival, in that we will have, again, as with the slave narratives is a perfect example of that, or the debriefing of a Secretary of State. In future years, it may become very important. People may want to. We take a lot of things for granted. I know I first got into oral history through interviewing my grandparents, particularly my grandfather, and I remember it occurred to me at that time that I had grown up as the grandson of immigrants, with full familiarity with the immigrant experience. Those accents were part of what I heard every day, the stories of the old country and so forth. And I realized that on some level, perhaps not so significant, my children and my grandchildren would not have any of that accessible to them. They would not hear these accents, and they would certainly not hear stories and hear reports about a world that had, taken place under very, very different circumstances from what surrounded them. So I was interested in recording some of that simply for personal and family reasons. And I think in many senses the impulse to oral history has been no more complicated than that for many people. It's the sense that there's a very rich body of experience that people carry with them in their lives and that very few people in the world leave without the assistance of something like this, very few people leave comprehensive records of that, usually. And in fact, usually those people are only very wealthy and powerful people who happen to be interviewed, who happen to have archives, who happen to write letters all the time that are collected in some important place. And for most of the rest of us, the experience just passes away and is not carried forth. And as the pace of change accelerates very quickly from generation to generation, so that the world that one generation lives in is going to be vastly different than that that their parents, much less their grandparents, much less their great-grandparents lived in. It will be much harder increasingly to retrieve some sense of what things felt like, what they look like, and the details themselves in terms of important historical events. And that combined with the accessibility of the tape recorder, and really it's a kind of democratizing device in that sense. It's not that hard to operate. It really opened to many people the possibility of assembling this kind of historical record in their own families, in their communities, in their neighborhoods, and so forth, has really encouraged this sense that we can preserve this material now while the people are still here. We can interact with them. We can talk about their lives and the experiences that they've had, and this will become a very valuable record for future generations. And in that sense, the impulse is like, I think, doing any history, that it's good to know about things. And in some ways, our own world is made richer by having a sense of where we came from and what went before us.
Now that you've heard some of the background and theory, this seems an appropriate time to listen to a short section of an oral history interview, this one with a Philadelphia Union activist, from a tape on deposit at the Urban Archives at Temple University.
I had my first taste of a labor conflict when I was living on 11th Street. This was when the trolley workers went out on strike. I don't remember what it was, 1906 or 1905, but it was somewhere within that time period. Mm-hmm. And they called out the state police. And we were playing, and children were playing on the street when we saw people gathering. And we didn't pay any attention to it until we saw people, men gathering and talking, you know, we'll get them, we'll tell them what it is, you know. And they were, well, we didn't pay any. All of a sudden, we heard the trolley car coming, and the men formed a line across the street. And as they did that, the Pennsylvania Mounted Police, they were then called the Pennsylvania Cossacks. They had the high hats with the clubs, billy clubs, and on their horses. And I saw my first charge of police into a labor group. And they really ran roughshod over them.
Just ran over
them,
the horses?
They were pushing and shoving many people. I saw many workers and many a policeman were laid out. Not that they killed, you know, but just injured. Naturally, we dispersed. I would tell you that in the 1929 strike, that is the organizational strike here, although the union itself was established in 1914, but it took all these years to finally crack the hard nut that was Philadelphia. During the 1929 strike, you know that people threw themselves in front of trucks, didn't want to let them pass. And what was happening was, it was happening all over the country, was the, as I understand it, now I have no proof of what I'm going to say, but these things actually happen, so we're pretty well sure of what we're saying, that there was a racket developed. Teamster would buy a truck, make an arrangement with some contractor in the country, and he'd go to New York or to Philadelphia and say, look, for so much and so much, I would have a garment made up for you, which was much less than what the union was demanding, always paying, you know. So the manufacturer, in order to stop the union, said, okay, he wanted his work done, and he couldn't get it done in his plant. So he didn't even know where his merchandise was going. In other words, he lost all control of his merchandise until he'd come back to him. So naturally, it came to the ears of the union officials, and they asked for volunteers, and they got plenty that actually threw themselves in front of trucks to prevent them from leaving plants. And the thing, we went out and we organized, we walked picket lines, we canvassed homes at night. I was threatened many a times, if you don't do this, you're gonna, if you don't lay off, you know, this is gonna happen. And
Were you frightened?
I sometimes wonder if I had brains enough to be frightened.
It was more important than you.
You know, it's just, it's hard to describe the feeling that you go through. It becomes a crusade.
The tape recorder has been an invention of tremendous influence on our culture, part of the technological revolution in communications media in the 19th and 20th centuries, that has resulted in, among other things, an informational explosion in which the amount of stored information has increased exponentially, while means of retrieval, interpretation, and use have lagged farther and farther behind. The effects this overload has had upon American culture are profound. We all know of the vast increase in material students must master in high school and college, and how all of this information has led to highly segmented specialization. Ironically, it has also contributed directly to Americans' loss of knowledge and interest in their past. The use of the tape recorder in oral history puts another twist into the picture, as along with videotape, it is a medium with tremendous potential for the decentralization of information and knowledge. It's inexpensive, it's easy to use, readily available, and in its use, to preserve the memories, thoughts, and life experiences of previously silent groups, it gives them a voice previously unknown. The new options the tape recorder offers was the next issue we discussed.
In its modern form, oral history was largely influenced by traditional historical research at the very beginning, and the Columbia Project, again, is the best example of that. In research like that, I guess you're interested in, for the most part, the particular experiences that important people, decision makers, or others have had. I would say, by and large, now the bulk of interest in oral history, particularly in its more widespread forms in local communities and historical societies and classrooms, in families and so forth, that the interest has been less in getting at that particular historical event and more at trying to get a generalized picture of what the immigrant experience was like or what a working-class neighborhood was like at a period of change. And that here, the sense is very much that we can get a view of this from the people themselves that may be very different than the images that have come down to us through the sources that historians have usually depended on, which have often been, you know, one insightful novelist or a particular poet or a documentary photographer. Well, these are all valuable in their own way, but somehow they're all filtered and they're all, you know, a viewpoint from a certain kind of perspective so that we can get a very different view and perhaps a more authentic view in some ways by talking to the people themselves who actually lived through the experience.
In many ways, it's a more intimate picture. It sort of establishes the bonds. I was just thinking it establishes the bonds on a one-to-one basis or, you know, with an actual person's life experiences instead of in great generalities about this many million people came at this point of time and they settled in these areas and then they moved up.
That's right.
Some social scientists or social scholars have been talking recently about the American Victorian neurosis was sex. This was the topic that was least discussed or had the greatest number of taboos, and that in modern America it's much more death or the sense of passage of time. Mm-hmm. And I think just from teaching, you know, introductory history courses in college, that the undergraduate or high school students do have a great deal of difficulty or they're unfamiliar with the whole feeling of what, you know, the experiential or affective feeling of history mm-hmm. and what it means and represents.
Well, that's true, and certainly, I mean, this gets to a whole other dimension, I think, of the current interest in oral history, which is that the process itself is a valuable thing for people to do. In some ways, it's often been observed that it's an artificial way to do what in the past perhaps happened more naturally, to have young people talk to their grandparents, to have people in a community talk to the elders in the community at a time now, you know, where so many of our living situations are kind of age segregated. People grow up in suburbs where there are very few older people who are all back in the old neighborhood or perhaps in a senior citizen's home and so forth. Families are often more fragmented, and many young people can go through their entire lives living largely with people of their own age. They go to school and they live mostly in their peer group as they, you know, leave high school. They go to college and they're living in dormitories or in apartment complexes.